Eoch tanuyap, kuige iwans kuyens na. Hi everybody, my name is Kuige Iwans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yagalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
My skin is black, my arms are long, my hair is woolly, my back is strong, strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah.
You're listening to Four Women, a song by Nina Simone on Vancouver Co-op Radio. This is Each for All, the cooperative connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio, broadcasting from the unceded traditional and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. You're listening to CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver and live online at coopradio.org. We also welcome our new listeners through Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY 93.5 FM in Nelson, BC. On today's show, we bring you the keynote speech from this past year's CAS conference. Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nembhard speaks on racial justice and cooperatives.
What do they call me? My name is Sophronia.
It is Black History Month in Canada, in the USA, and many other nations around the world. This is a time to honor these legacies, to learn more about these communities and how they continue to shape our future. It's also a time to examine, in hopes of better understanding, racial inequities and their roots, and to challenge ourselves and our communities to be better citizens of this world. As a Canadian, I've been deeply troubled by what's happening in our nation's capital and on the roads across our country. A loud, vocal, very privileged minority group of our fellow citizens are feeling emboldened by a swell of social media support and have laid siege to our capital city. The protest scenes in Ottawa and across the country have been marred by hate symbols and even disrespect of some of our most cherished symbols. It is very hard to understand what is motivating these occupiers in Ottawa. What fanned the flames of their distrust of government so much? Why are we continuing to allow misinformation and hate-filled propaganda to proliferate? Who are these Canadians walking through our streets with flags of hate and racial intolerance? And how is rebel news still allowed to exist? These are the troubling thoughts that swirl through the head from my comfy bubble in the privileged neighborhood of East Vancouver. Well, one thing we have always prided ourselves on here at Each for All is our desire to fight ignorance with education. This week, we bring you the keynote speech from last year's CAS conference. The Canadian Association for Studies and Cooperation, or CASC, is a multidisciplinary network of researchers and practitioners whose work involves cooperatives and cooperation. Each for All has a long association with CASC, and we have covered CASC conferences going as far back as 2006. In recent years, in 2018 and 2019, Each for All covered CASC conferences and brought you, our listeners, the highlights. And even some of our members have been on the board of CASC, Vesta Siachu in 2019-2020, and myself in 2007-2009. Well, tonight, we continue to honor our CASC connection and give thanks for permitting us to broadcast the keynote speech from last year's conference. Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nembhard speaks on racial justice and cooperatives. Dr. Gordon-Nembhard sets up a concise and gripping historical overview based on her recent publication, Black Cooperatives, Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. But this is not a history lesson. This is the setup for a challenge to the cooperative sector and to CASC, a call to action from Dr. Gordon-Nembhard. We need to recognize how we perpetuate racism, to understand how we engage in microaggressions, and we need to fight this tokenized diversity. This is not an easy keynote, but an all too important topic and all too relevant for this month. Let's hear Dr. Isabel Finley, professor at the University of Saskatchewan and CASC treasurer, introduce our speaker for this evening.
So good morning and welcome to this keynote address and open CASC answer joint session, which has been generously funded by the International Keynote Fund of the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. I want to acknowledge that I am joining you today from Treaty 6 territory, which is also the territory of the host institution, U of Alberta, and the traditional homeland of the Métis. As treaty beneficiaries, we pay our respects to the First Nations and Métis ancestors of this place and reaffirm our relationship with one another. We acknowledge, too, the ancestral and unceded territory of all Inuit, First Nation, and Métis of this land. And for me, it's a special pleasure to introduce this year's academic keynote speaker, my friend and colleague, Jessica Gordon-Nembhard. She's an outstanding leader in the field of cooperative studies. She's an award-winning author and academic, a longtime member of the Canadian Association for Studies in Cooperation, and winner of our 2017 Award of Merit. And she's a tireless advocate for social, economic, and racial justice. I have always envied her academic titles. She is Professor of Community Justice and Social Economic Development in the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College City, University of New York. She's a political economist committed to community economics and Black political economy. Throughout her career, she's been a trailblazer, an inspiration, an institution critic and builder. In the early 2000s, when she was an assistant professor at Maryland, she co-founded the Democracy Collaborative. She's also a founding board member of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. She's co-founded so many organizations. She's been a visiting scholar at my own home institution, the Canadian Centre for the Study of Cooperatives at the University of Saskatchewan, where she remains a valued fellow. Since 2007, she's been on the board of directors of ACE, the Association of Cooperative Educators. And in 2016, she was inducted to the Cooperative Hall of Fame, the highest award given by the cross-sector US cooperative community. She's the author of that path-breaking book, Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice, that built on her years of research to tell those stories that were too little known or unknown. In addition to those diverse academic, administrative, and activist roles, Jessica is a member of the Council of Cooperative Economists, committed to providing information to the co-op sector, policymakers, thought leaders, and other stakeholders, so that we have those supports to make the change we want. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nembhard. Her topic today is racial justice and cooperatives. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Isabel. You didn't have to read through all that. And actually, as of last year, I'm not on the ACE board anymore, but I was for about 10 years, or maybe more. So just a correction, a about that. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, everybody. I'm going to share my screen. So thanks to CASC and to Answer for having me. We had the land acknowledgement already, but I'll also just acknowledge I'm on Lenape Nation land. I also want to acknowledge our ancestors and our elders, especially my ancestors, the struggles of enslaved laborers, all those who labor without just compensation, acknowledge our claim to land and resources. And I want to acknowledge our histories of agency, cooperation, and resistance. So it's not just about being victims and victimized, but the ways we have resisted, especially using collective economics and collective action. I also need to mention, and I talked to Judith about this before I re-agreed to do this, is that I do have to recognize that I'm in solidarity with those who are boycotting this year's Congress because of lack of racial inclusion and accessibility. And I also promised myself that I would mention that there's also challenges to CASC itself for not including or making Canadians of African descent comfortable in the organization. And so I do want to make sure that we acknowledge that and work to do better. You'll see, have a lot of slides in here about actions that we have to take to create racial justice in our co-ops and all our organizations. And so I'll challenge CASC from the beginning to look into that more and to figure out how to remedy that. I also want us to remember, I know right recently we're remembering the 215 children and then the other graves that are found or not found yet. I want to also recognize those fallen, killed by police brutality, other forms of anti-Blackness, racism and sexism in both of our countries. And I also want to acknowledge and remember the Black, Indigenous people of color co-ops that have been sabotaged, which I'll talk about in a minute. I also want to just say I'm not that comfortable with the BIPOC language, Black, Indigenous people of color. I don't have good, you know, sometimes I say people of color, sometimes I say Black and brown people, sometimes I say Black, Indigenous, and Latinx people, but that's what I mean. I'm using BIPOC because it's easier and it's kind of something, I guess, what in the last year we've all started to embrace, but I want to recognize we don't have good words yet for what I would call subaltern peoples, particularly who suffer from anti-Blackness and racism. And then I do also just want to mention one of our co-op research colleagues, Johnston Burchell, who we just lost him, I guess it was last week now. And so just remember, rest in peace or rest in cooperation, we could say. So I thought we had a great start yesterday with Louise Champagne and the others in that first opening program. And I wrote down immediately when Louise said, we need to acknowledge more. It's not good enough to just do a land acknowledgement. You see, I also do ancestor and elder acknowledgements, but I agree with her. It's not enough to just do those acknowledgements. We need to acknowledge the damage done, and then we need to pledge to take action. I'll also use another term. It's the same concept from Randall Robinson in his book about the debt, What America Owes Blacks. And he says, but first the victims must be noticed. They must be seen. And so I'm going to give you a little bit of the history of the damage done to African-American cooperatives, but then I want us to focus on two aspects. One, the way that African-Americans used cooperatives to attain some level of racial justice, and also the challenge again to ourselves in the co-op movement, especially the North American co-op movement, that we haven't really addressed racial justice enough. So throughout North American history, we know the colonialism and settler attitudes, right, have kind of tainted the co-op movement. When you look closely at what our history is and how co-ops have been used to remove people from their land and to unsettle Indigenous peoples from their livelihoods, that kind of thing. We had good conversations about that yesterday with Mitch and Isabel and others. So I won't go into too much detail of that. the asset stripping that we know has happened, not just in terms of people in co-ops, but in generally, again, BIPOC people, land stripping, bodies being stripped, culture, language being stripped, inventions being stripped from us, businesses being taken from us, et cetera. And so I want to make sure we acknowledge those, that kind of history. And then specifically, I'm going to talk about the economic and financial sabotage against Black co-ops, where white competitors and white supremacists use financial sabotage, like refusing bank loans and lines of credit, charging exorbitant interest and fees, and using excessive and unfair competition specifically against Black co-ops so that the Black co-ops couldn't thrive or survive. And again, I'll give you a couple of examples of that. And then the gambit of sabotage is not just sort of the financial kinds of sabotage, but all the way to physical violence and terrorism that white supremacists have perpetrated against African-American cooperatives and their members. So burning down buildings and actually lynching co-op members. So a lot of this is in my book that's already been mentioned, Collective Courage. I also worked with Esther West at the University of Wisconsin Center for Cooperatives, and last year she put out a study of Latinx co-ops. Though she didn't do a history, she just tried to look at what was happening with Latinx co-ops currently, 2019-2020. But I just wanted to mention that those resources are there, this information is there. I also recently published an article on sabotage against Black co-ops, the case for reparations. And so some of this also comes from that work. So what's the sabotage look like? So if we go back to the 1880s, which is actually a similar period in time politically and economically to now, right? Both a very repressive time in terms of political repression and some economic challenges, but also a time of very strong progressive populist union co-op and integration movements in the face of all that repression. But in terms of the sabotage against co-ops, we know after the Haymarket strikes in 1886, the Knights of Labor, which was the most progressive integrated union, which also promoted worker co-ops and other co-ops, right, was targeted. The railroads refused to haul co-op products. Manufacturers refused to sell the machinery that was needed. Wholesalers refused raw materials and supplies, and banks wouldn't lend. So again, the whole gamut of sabotage. Most of the co-ops, most of the 200 co-ops that the Knights of Labor had started in the 1880s were forced to close by the end of 1888. And the unions, actually, the progressive unions were in decline at that period, if you can believe that, after actually having a bit of a heyday in the early 1880s. In terms specifically, and as I said, the Knights of Labor was an integrated union, but specifically in terms of Black co-ops, the Colored Farmers National Alliance and Cooperative Union, which also grew up in the 1880s with a purpose to use co-ops to stop white merchants' monopolies and to stop African-Americans from doing business with those monopolistic merchants because they were making them go into debt and weren't providing them the right materials, weren't hiring other Blacks, that kind of thing. Well, the Colored Farmers National Alliance and Cooperative Union efforts were so successful that white business community retaliated. One of the most written about of those retaliations was in Mississippi, LaFleur County, where the white business community threatened and defamed one of the leaders of the chapter, the CFNACU chapter, and then attacked the chapter offices. The chapter members and the community defended not only their leader, but defended the office. And that led to a massacre. The local white business community created a posse with the Ku Klux Klan. They got the governor to call in the National Guard, and the guardsmen actually arrested some of the alliance men, the colored alliance men, and handed them over to the posse. And then the posse massacre, there's no good evidence, but between 25 and 100 Black co-op members, killing some in their homes, shooting some down in the woods, and actually lynching others. No whites are killed. So that's, sort of the worst of white supremacist terrorism. We also know that by the 1920s, the National Federation of Colored Farmers also had a mission to use cooperatives to help Black farmers with ownership of land, cooperative buying, production, and marketing. I guess this is a Mississippi example again, but these things happen throughout the US, not even just throughout the US South. But there was a purchasing co-op in 1929 in the Howard, Mississippi chapter, which actually was providing better prices than the white-owned store. Again, the white planters and merchants tried to shut it down, tried to stop people from using their own co-op, stopped giving advances on wages to the laborers, Black laborers, so then they couldn't put money into the co-op or have any cash to buy from the co-op. And then they accused the NFCF of swindling their members by charging dues. The group was was able to succeed for 5 more years. They expanded the number and kinds of items that they could buy wholesale. They started buying trucks together, livestock. They expanded in the cities, not just in the South, but in Chicago, New York, Baltimore. And many of the laborers and sharecroppers who started out in the organization were able to become farm owners because of this. So even though they were sabotaged in many different ways, they were able to succeed. Fast forward now to the 1970s, Apex Taxi Cab Cooperative in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, had 30 new cabs, all Black drivers. Their competitive advantage was that they're willing to take passengers to any part of the city, meaning to the Black communities, where the white cab companies were not willing to. But after 18 months, their insurance premium skyrocketed because they were going into those Black neighborhoods and they couldn't afford it. And so they had to disband. And so again, that's more of the financial sabotage side. And finally, new communities had a combination of financial and terrorist activity. It's an intentional community and cooperative farm society. It's actually considered the first modern community land trust in the United States. And it was the largest African-American-owned parcel of land when it bought it in the 1960s. For 15 years, they tried to survive attempts to shut them down, denial of loans, other kinds of sabotage. And then after successive years of drought, the land was foreclosed on them. But they testify that for over 15 years, they had white competitors who didn't want them to exist shooting into their offices, diluting their fertilizer, polluting their water. And then they were refused loans by the US Department of Agriculture in addition to regular banks. They actually were part of the Pigford court case. And after 10 years, they won a settlement, which allowed them to buy new land and start over. But again, sabotage examples. So I have a quote from Clyde Woods to kind of sum up, right, both the challenges of these kinds of sabotage against Black cooperative efforts, but also the resistance and resilience. And so I also want to make sure we don't just talk about the victimization and how people were victimized, but the agency, resistance, and what collective action did. And so this kind of sums that up. Generation after generation, ethnic and class alliances arose in the region with the aim of expanding social economic democracy. And he's talking about for African Americans, only to be ignored, dismissed, and defeated. These defeats were arrogant attempts to purge such heroic movements from both historical text and popular memory. Yet even in defeat, these movements transformed the policies of the plantation bloc and informed daily life, community building activities, and subsequent movements. And you'll see also most of my book is about the survival and the success of Black co-ops. And one of the other things that we see is the way the co-ops kind of went from being economic survival activities to economic independence and liberation activities, which is also why they were so dangerous, right, to the white supremacist society. So we use mutual aid and economic cooperation first because we didn't have any wealth, right? As enslaved peoples, we didn't even own our own bodies, let alone have any other wealth. Even after emancipation, we were excluded from stable and lucrative economic activities. And so co-ops filled in those gaps for us, allowed us to eat, helped us to own land or equipment or something to do our work, right? We used co-ops to survive depressions, economic exclusion, discrimination, marginalization, and other forms of economic inequality. But then we also were able to use co-ops to control income generation and even wealth creation and create some level of economic independence. I've talked lots of times about some of the examples like Freedom Quilting Bee in Alabama in the 60s and 70s, allowing sharecropping women to get extra income by selling quilts. And they were able to buy land and use that to help other sharecroppers to get out of sharecropping conditions, to help support sharecroppers who were thrown off their land for registering to vote. They were able to provide daycare and after school programming for their children, all because of the co-op. So it's that's the other part of what I mean by economic independence that gets that's gained by using co-ops. We've got Helena Wilson from the Ladies Auxiliary to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in the 30s and 40s, talking about, right, no race can be one other's equal if you can't protect our own interests, right? And we can do that through uniting our forces and pooling our funds for the common good of all. So again, how to use co-ops for liberation, not just for survival. A. Philip Randolph, also of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, but also a Black activist and leader in his own, you know, for a number of reasons, talked about cooperatives are the best mechanism to bring about economic democracy. Fannie Lou Hamer in the 70s, right, a voting rights advocate, also became a cooperative advocate and talked about cooperative ownership of land, opens opportunities for group development, right, to help everybody rather than to monopolize resources. And so again, this notion of liberation, not just survival, but liberation, democracy, and then group development and community development. And so I'll go through this quickly because I want to talk about how I want to challenge us to do better in the co-op movement. But we know that African-American co-ops and actually most co-ops have helped, right? Providing goods and quality, goods and services of high quality and geographic and culturally sensitive goods and services, saving costs, combating discrimination and exclusion, increasing stability and self-sufficiency, creating decent jobs, providing and developing collective agency and action and developing leadership, and addressing, you know, all these issues, both of economic and social isolation, marginalization, and inequality. Tom just this morning used this quote by Du Bois about how we can use cooperatives, right, to establish a progressively self-supporting economy that would wield the majority of our people into an impregnable economic phalanx. So again, this notion that with collective economics, right, we can protect ourselves and have self-determination and prosperity. But most of that has had to be achieved separately with voluntary segregation, right? Blacks creating their own co-ops. We haven't really gotten that far. We haven't gotten from survival to liberation in integrated co-ops. I think it's similar for women, right? Women took a long time for women to get equal status in co-ops. I think First Nations would say similarly, right? They had to self-organize and create and control their own co-ops in order to really endure marginality and invisibility. But why, right? Why do we have to, why have we only been able to really achieve this through segregation, right? Segregated, separate co-ops, because we live in a racialized society. And so that's the part I want to challenge us to really, to recognize and be proactive about addressing that.
You're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection, on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver, live online at cooperadio.org. And now back to the keynote presentation from last year's Canadian Association for Studies in Cooperation Conference. This is Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nembhard on racial justice and cooperatives.
So how do we recognize the ways that we perpetuate institutional racism and engage in racist microaggressions and exclusion as the co-op movement, right? And as a co-op movement, we think of ourselves as liberals and, right, and we're always doing the right thing. We're better than everybody else, but we haven't done a good job in the racial justice area. We just haven't. First, the missing in action, right? There's very few BIPOC people in co-ops. Even now, the numbers are much better, right? There's very few BIPOC developers. That's getting better. But, you know, when I started, there was very little, except some of the co-ops in the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. The other problem we have is we focus on individuals, not groups. So we feel happy, right? We think we've been done great. You've got one Black person. You know, for years, I was the one Black co-op scholar at all the conferences, and everyone thought that was fine, right? I was the one who kept saying, where are the rest of the Blacks? Why don't we have more Black people? Why don't we know about more Black co-ops? But everybody else thought, okay, they got me, so that's everything's good, right? So diversity was tokenized. It was about individuals. It wasn't about how we dealt with groups, whether we were comfortable including groups, different groups and populations of people, right? We were happy if we had one First Nations rep. And so everybody was tokenized, and you all were happy with it. I was never happy being a token. I'm still not happy being a token, and I'm still not happy being asked to be the spokesperson for everybody else. But I'm willing to be the one to start these conversations and to ask some of the hard questions. And how do we've been perpetuating racism in our co-ops, right? By allowing the invisibility of informal economic cooperation and solidarity that BIPOC people practice, right? We still, you know, talk about cooperative movement starting with Rochdale, right? We still talk about, you know, the first credit unions being in Germany or whatever without talking about ROSCAs or any other revolving credit and informal credit associations, right? And so we still are perpetuating a Europeanized notion of what cooperative economics is and what cooperatives are, even though, you know, it's fine to recognize that, you know, internationally, the principles and incorporation characteristics of co-ops were codified in Europe, right, with the International Cooperative Alliance starting in 1896 or whenever it started. But we don't really recognize all the other forms and ways that cooperation happened, and that every human being really has practiced solidarity economics and some kind of cooperative economics. We don't recognize the early First Nations, early African civilizations that thrived on cooperation and economic balance. So we're missing that. So then that means our materials are biased, right? We don't recognize in our materials the universality of cooperativism. We're missing other histories and examples, right? Those colonizing histories and settler attitudes, you know, sit right on top of our organizations. And hinder us from either seeing or acknowledging or embracing or making other people feel comfortable. And then the invisible white privilege that Isabel also started talking about yesterday, the McIntosh work on the backpack of invisible white privilege is really important and really helps. Like she talks about, you know, she can go into a store and not be followed. You know, there's no assumption that she's going to steal, but a Black person, you know, any Black person would go into a store and gets followed with assumption that they might be stealing, right? Or she talks about how she can criticize an organization or her government without being, you know, seen as, oh, you know, your race always says that or always does that or whatever. And so anyway, it's a great toolbox to look at to help us understand and see privilege in the same way that sort of we started to understand male privilege with the women's movement. There's also more subtle issues we have to address, the income and wealth assumptions, right? I know in the US until recently, the food co-ops, right, made assumptions about income, right, that middle class and middle class white people were the best places to start and to locate a food co-op because we knew that they would be able to pay the prices or participate, right? So assumptions about people with wealth or certain levels of income are the better targets or can make better, stronger co-ops without trying to address the other issues. The siloing, right, the way that sectors are so isolated, both urban, rural, regional, but also by type, right, the worker co-ops, which are much more utilized by people of BIPOC people and much more democratic, right, have always been sort of the black sheep, at least in the US. They're the smallest sector, I think, in Canada also. So the siloing is another issue that if we really want to address racial justice, we've got to come to focus on that education is internally focused, and we know how important that is. And I'm one of the first people to talk about how important internal education is for co-op and co-op success. But if we don't talk about co-ops publicly and have national dialogues and teach our young people about co-ops, then again, only right the people, the privileged people who have time and energy to think about alternatives and to learn about them are going to know about co-ops and know that it's an option. And then I would say the fear of racial equity, right? People actually aren't comfortable, right, with racial equity. They're more comfortable with just saying, oh yeah, let's just have a lot of diverse people here and that's fine. But you can't, if you don't have real inclusion and equity, then having diversity isn't enough. And we have to figure out how to become comfortable with real racial equity. So diversity and inclusion are not enough, right? Tolerance and sympathy are not enough. It's not enough just to be a smiling ally, right? We have to be deliberate and proactive about resisting the normality and acceptance of the presumption of racial inequality. And so we have to, right? We've got to fight. So we need to take action. A colleague of mine in the Association of Social Economics has language talks about being actively anti-discriminatory rather than passively non-discriminatory. And I think most of our groups, especially in co-ops and progressive groups, we've been happy being passively non-discriminatory. And I'm challenging us to be actively anti-discriminatory, be proactive about recognizing and rooting out anti-Blackness. That's the other thing. It can't just be about racism. We have to be honest, right, that racism starts with anti-Blackness. And so we have to root out anti-Blackness and then other forms of racism and discrimination in our co-ops and in our movement. I also use a quote from Mari Matsuda in an early article she wrote about reparations. And she says, reparations is at its heart transformative. It recognizes the crimes of the powerful against the powerless. It condemns exploitation and adopts a vision of a more just world. And so I want to challenge us to do that, right? Recognize the crimes of the powerful against the powerless. I want us to condemn exploitation, right? Not just talk about how bad it is or that we're trying not to do it or whatever. We need to condemn it and stop it from happening. And then adopt, right? We do pretty well with the vision of a more just world, but we haven't done very well with how do we make sure that really happens and that's accessible to everybody. And so I've been arguing that, you know, racial justice requires economic justice and economic democracy. We'll never really get full racial justice without the economic democracy. But guess what? We can't achieve economic democracy in a racialized, racist, male privilege context. So we've got to, right, we've got to figure out how do we address not just the economic democracy part, which we do fairly well as co-operators, but how do we also address the racial justice issues in our own movement again? So here I just want to list out some of the things we can do. Some of this stuff Isabel actually mentioned yesterday, so I didn't put all of her stuff, but I just put a couple of things, or maybe it's not a couple. I think I still have about 5 minutes left, but I'll try to go quickly and people can ask me to come back to it if you want. But right, we have to pay attention to power relationships and microaggressions. We have to recognize the importance of BIPOC communities and organizations, right? That's back to, we have to think about groups, not just individuals, right? We have to recognize the importance of women of color, because if you don't know it, right, women of color are actually very strong in this movement. I noted in my book, because I found in my research how strong Black women were, but if you look at the growing worker co-op movement, it's mostly a women of color movement, at least in the US, I think probably in Canada as well. So we need to recognize that importance and figure out how to engage at that level, right? We need to focus on organizing, connecting with communities and members in respectful, culturally appropriate ways. That's sort of back to my thing about recognizing the importance of community and organization in BIPOC communities, but we also have to do the organizing. And see ourselves as organizers, right? Bringing people in, listening to what people need, bringing them in and connecting to their needs, to our stuff. Practicing popular education to make sure, again, the information is accessible and relevant. Just a side thing, why I talk about, you know, group and community are so important is one of the things I found in my research with Black co-ops is how important connecting co-op movement and Black organizations was, that in the periods of time when there were the most number of co-ops developed were the periods of time when the strongest, largest Black organizations were also doing co-op promotion and co-op education. And then I also found that the strongest co-ops also had community support, both to support, to protect them from the sabotage, but also, right, to use the co-op, to engage the co-op, to be customers of the co-op and to understand what the co-op was doing. And so that's why I talk about the need to engage BIPOC organizations. I talked about the roles of women already, right? There's strong roles in communities in general, but they're very strong in the solidarity and cooperative movements. And if our bigger movement doesn't recognize the role of women of color, then we're not going to be able to achieve racial justice. We also need to bring in youth. In the Black co-op movement, engaging youth was extremely important. And one of the things that happened, again, in most of the successful co-ops, updating our materials with practices and case studies of BIPOC people and people's histories, right? People need to see themselves in the materials, see the legacy of their own communities and their own groups, embrace cultural diversity. And then we talked about this yesterday, language justice, right? We've got to practice all kinds of language justice in our co-op movements, you know, like we have interpretation here. And we've got to distribute the power, rethink and rewrite our development strategies with BIPOC people so that with is important, right? Not for, but with. We need to address BIPOC issues and conditions with the co-op model. We need to unpack white privilege. We need to diversify power relationships and decision-making, right? It's not enough to be invited to the dance, right? Which is sort of diversity, right? It's not even enough to be asked to the dance, which is the way people describe, inclusion, right? So inclusion would be being asked to the dance. Diversity is just being invited, right? Neither of those are enough, right? That's where we talk about equity and justice. We need to, people need to be part of the planning and the design, right? Not just invited to the dance or asked to dance, but part of the actual decision-making, designing, planning, et cetera. And that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about distributing a power. And that's what I mean when I say diversity and inclusion are not enough. Ray Marshall, who was the Secretary of Labor under Carter, talks about the whole reason for forming co-ops is to give people independence so they can have independence in political and other matters. So he talks about stepping stone of co-ops to give you some political power and other kinds of power. But we also know that if we don't, right, if we don't have integral into our co-ops that diversity of power and power relations, then we're not going to do it. And then we need resources, right? Obviously, the co-op movement needs to put money into, right, covering the costs of diversity, inclusion, and equity, right? We've got to be willing to put that money out or to share costs or take money from the very lucrative sectors and put it into the sectors that are struggling. We need money to create these new materials and to distribute news materials, right? We need those structures, fill the structural holes and use the triple recognitions that Mitch was talking about. And we also need to put money into BIPOC co-op development, right? Because again, those many of those communities don't even have the extra resources to do the beginnings of co-op development. And so we need to recognize those things. Oh, So now I rushed through it and I'm finished. Sorry, I thought I had a few more slides. So I did want to leave you with two questions. There's probably more questions you could think of, but you know, what are you prepared to do? Because as I said, I'm trying to challenge this as a challenge. We all have to do better. This movement has to do better. What are you prepared to do? And what are some next steps towards social justice and racial equity in the co-op movement, in CASC, in the co-op movement, in both of our countries that people are ready to pledge and have ideas for how to move forward? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for these incredible challenges and reminders that things are not just the way they are. They are that way because of powerful discourses and material practices, including state violence, which you showed in some of your examples. And complacency does kill. And so I'm wondering what others have to say about the challenges and how we can take those challenges up, both within CASC and within the broader co-op movement. Okay, nothing in the chat.
Yeah, I noticed the last 2 days, people have been very quiet. I'm not sure why, because we've had really rich and provocative presentations.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, you've made so clear the extent to which that Eurocentric narrative of where cooperation began erases, you know, centuries of cooperative practice in Black, Indigenous, you know, all sorts of communities, all of which could enrich us all. Ah, we've got a question. Please feel free to unmute and put on your video and ask your question.
Hello. My question, thank you for the presentation, first of all. And I was just wondering, because there were some points that kind of showed that the violence towards people of color is coming from up top, like from the government being complacent. So I don't know how we can make progress if the government is the one like kind of sabotaging those efforts. Like it's a little bit confusing for me too.
Right. I mean, it is a little overwhelming, but I would say that the sabotage comes from all sides. So there's definitely state violence and government complicity. You know, sometimes the government the role the government plays is more on the financial side, right? A lot of the issues for the U.S. Blacks was the U.S. government, Department of Ag and its other finance institutions wouldn't give loans to Black farmers, wouldn't give loans for Black land ownership, wouldn't give loans for co-ops. And we do have lawsuits, right? So there's lawsuits, there's exposing that, right? So at that level, but a lot of the sabotage is really not, it's really more grassroots sabotage. It's the white neighbors, it's the white business people that the Black co-ops were taking business away from, right? So a lot of the sabotage was that, or corporations, right? So again, part of it is the exposure, right? Exposing that they're doing this. And then part of it is, you know, both self-defense, and, you know, I hate to say that on a recording, but the need for self-defense, all different kinds of self-defense, right? And then the need for alternative strategies, that's where the community support and organizational support comes in. That's why I mentioned how important for, at least for African-Americans, and I assume for many other BIPOC groups, having the community support you, sometimes physically protecting your co-op, but also supporting what you're doing in a number of ways. Sometimes community have been giving donations and give, you know, patient capital loans and stuff to the co-op. So that kind of support has been really important, support from Black organizations that either can help raise money to give donations or can do the education part, right? So all those, so there's a, it's sort of a whole ecosystem of different kinds of supports which can address those issues. And then the last thing I wanted to say, which I think I said in my talk, but I just wanted to make sure before we go too far, is it's not all about being victimized, right? The co-ops also were very empowering on a number of ways, right? Just stabilizing income, creating leadership, creating wealth. So we, you know, we have, it's a very dialectical relationship that BIPOC people have had with co-ops and the co-op movement. So there's a lot of things that have been supportive and agentic and helped in resistance and independence and self-determination at the same time that there's other elements that have been repressive and discriminatory.
Okay, thank you very much. Because I think for me, I just go to a point where I like just felt kind of discouraged with everything that's going on. For example, like I think just recently, Premier Jason Kenney was kind of, I don't know, trying to change the curriculum or something like that. So I feel like that's kind of a step backwards because we like we need to learn these things so that we don't repeat them. So if the government is trying to block steps like that, I just felt like, so how can we make any progress, right?
Right. So that's where we have to petition the government, but also we can take things into our own hands, right? Mm-hmm. That's the other thing I noticed that a lot of the Black cooperators did. They started having their own courses, teaching their own classes, having study groups where they learn together, the stuff that they realized they needed to know that they didn't know, right? Even the Black Panther Party did Black education, you know, Black history and education while they were feeding children breakfast, things like that. So there's a lot of ways too to take it into your own hands until you can force your government to do the right thing. Mm. I think there's two other
Jen?
Thanks, Isabel. I guess one of the things that I wonder about is, especially for these larger organizations, what does it mean for them to become, you know, what would it mean for them to become spaces for social justice or socially just organizations? And can they even do it when they all seem to be addicted to this growth model, this colonial, modern, capitalist growth model, even the larger co-ops? And you know, there's so much of that that's about trying to generate and hold on to excess resources. And so many white people, even here in this panel, like we have too much. And in a global sense, you know, I don't know if we're going to achieve social justice while we stay addicted to all of our stuff, right? So I don't, that's not a very clear question, but I just like to get your thoughts around that because I feel like there's something we're still not getting at somehow.
Right, yeah, no, it's a good question. And it is, it's a quandary. It's part of the problem because we live in a racialized capitalist system, right? So what do you do short of being able to destroy that system, which we can't do easily? Right? What do you sort of do in the interim? And in the interim, is that just reform, right? Which is always the question, right? So for me, there's a couple things. One, I actually honestly believe that the more people who practice solidarity, cooperative economics, the more people will see that we don't need capitalism and will gain skill, values and skills and practices that could help us to transform or defeat capitalism. Now it's a long, you know, that's a long sort of evolutionary view, but I honestly believe that. But what do we do while we're in that evolutionary process and while we're trying to do that? Well, one is we've got to still make sure we educate ourselves and each other enough so that we can see that we should be doing these practices as much as we can to move towards something, right? So that's part of it. But the other thing is that's really fascinating in economics is that industrial organization, you know, since the 80s has actually realized that economic democracy, workplace democracy is actually more productive. And so in some ways, a lot of the most progressive or business schools, they're not teaching cooperative economics, but they are teaching about teamwork and labor management, joint committees and all that kind of stuff. So they're like just on the edge, on the verge of some of this stuff. So even if you can just get those corporate spaces to do more, right? And they're recognizing now, especially as North America, or at least the United States, is becoming much more diverse, racially diverse, that they have to have some level of diversity in their organizations. They have to pay some attention to diversity in order to even get, you know, get customers. They've got it right. So I do feel hopeful on the sort of superficial side that there's movement and continuing movement, and that there's justifications for that movement in their terms. But how do we get people to really do the, you know, the, what's my word? The subversive stuff, right? I really feel like we need to build from below. Sometimes I use the analogy of a blizzard, right? You know how snow is so light and fluffy, right? It comes down, it seems so innocuous, but by the time you get 6, 8, 10, 12, 18 feet, it can stop everything and destroy or recast the whole thing. So I feel like we need to be that blizzard, right? Come softly, gently, slowly, build up, keep doing, right? Almost sometimes inadvertent, you know, people don't even notice that we're, that we're getting deeper and bigger and whatever. And then at some point people wake up and, oh my gosh, we've taken over most of the systems. Most people understand better how we want to be. Again, it's a little bit optimistic, but that's the only way I know how to think, is to be optimistic that we can build that way. But that's where we have to unite, right? We all have to unite together. We all have to embrace each other's issues. And then we have to understand how to get the word out and get people doing more and more of these practices.
We have run out of time, so I'm going to very quickly thank everyone. Thank you, Jessica. There were more questions coming, and a renewed thanks to the Federation for sponsoring this open session. And thank you all so much. And
thanks,
enjoy the
thanks
rest
everybody.
Of the day. Thank you, Jessica.
You've been listening to the keynote presentation from last year's Canadian Association for Studies and Cooperation Conference. Dr. Jessica Gordon-Nampard presented on racial justice and cooperatives. This was an enlightening speech for understanding the somewhat hidden or perhaps somewhat forgotten history of Black cooperatives in America. It's amazing to hear the impact of these cooperatives had on their communities to stabilize incomes and support wealth accumulation, and so troubling to hear how these cooperatives were marginalized and demonized by racist communities and even elected officials. The challenge to the cooperative sector from Dr. Gordon-Nampard is to recognize how we continue to perpetuate racism, to understand how we engage in microaggressions, and to fight tokenized diversity. These are important challenges for us to engage in. It's not easy, but I trust our listeners can come up with better solutions than parking our vehicles on Parliament's lawn. That's it for us here on Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Our sincere thanks to the CASC for its permission to broadcast this presentation. We hope to bring you more presentations from CASC in the upcoming months and after its conference in May of 2022. To find out more about the Canadian Association for Studies and Cooperation, please visit our website, sorry, their website, at cooperesearch.coop. And thanks for listening. This has been another episode of Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. I'm your host, Robin Puga. And you've been listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO, 100.5 FM in Vancouver. If you would like to get in contact with us here at Each for All, please email us at ideas@eachforall.coop or tweet us at Each for All on Twitter. Our website is eachforall.coop, and we'll have this episode posted there shortly. That's it for us here. Have a cooperative week. Look forward to talking with you all again in 7 days. You're listening to Toronto's Mustafa with their song Stay Alive on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Be yours or mine, but I'll be your empire. Just stay alive, stay alive, stay alive.
I've been trying to keep my cool, man, before I lose it.
These colors and flags, the sweat on your back, you're doing what you can. Pride in your hand, a price on your head, you can never let them win. Just put down that bottle, tell me your sorrows, I care about you, fam. I care about you, fam, oh, oh. All of these traps, and all of these dreams.